Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Beyond, and hello everyone, my name is Jonathan Dornbush, and this is Podcast Beyond, episode 696 of IGN's weekly PlayStation show. That's such a high number, every time I say it now, it just feels so strange. The gang is here, the whole gang is back. I feel like I'm on a reunion episode years after the fact, but we're all back together, and we have actually quite a lot of PlayStation news to jump into. But before we begin, I'm joined this week by Brian Altano.
Hey, PlayStation.
Lucy O'Brien.
I feel like I look like I'm on a reunion episode years after the fact.
And Max Scoville's back. Hey, Max.
Hey, it's good to be back.
Glad to have you back.
I love to go to work. It's good. It's a good time to wake up at, you know, whenever the alarm clock
to
makes
work.
You.
You work
I don't, no, it's true. It's actually deeply anticlimactic. Like, my wife was really upset. Like, I'm going to be horrible when you're off paternity leave. And it's like, I just go in this room. Like, it's not, nothing's different, you know? Like, I'm still changing diapers and getting up and stuff. Anyway, yeah, good to be back. PlayStation, everybody.
Well, and also, since this is now, we said it, of course, while you were off the air, but congratulations.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
The newest member of the Scoville family.
The newest PlayStation family member. Or whatever.
I think Kratos is a weird name for a little girl, but I support
you. Hey, she was born with that weird, she had the white and the tribal tattoo face thing and a little soul patch, like the guy from Godsmack. It just seemed like a good name, you know?
Yeah. I feel like we should talk about why that was the choice you made, but yeah, that's other than that, congratulations to you, but we're glad to have you back, and we're glad to have you back, especially in a week where there is a lot of PlayStation news to discuss, both on the firmware and software side, because we've learned about some possible unannounced Sony games, both canceled and maybe not, that we'll dig into in a little bit. But the biggest thing that I want to talk about that is happening actually today, as we're recording the show and the day it goes live now, is that the PS5 has gotten its first big update. There have been, I think since launch, a lot of requests for a lot of different features. Obviously, the PS5 UI is completely different from the PS4 UI, and there's been a lot of changes, both some that I think have been more well-received than others. But just to quickly run it down, the update is available right now. It changes some things, like you are able to finally download PS5 games to external USB drives. You can't play them off there, but you can at least actually download them to there instead of just deleting and re-downloading. There are now new social features, so you can actually do share play cross-generation. So you technically don't need a PS5 to play a PS5 game. You just need a friend who has a PS5 to share play with you their PS5 games. And then in addition to that, there's been some changes to the game base, some other pre-download and game library customization options, some slight changes to the trophy settings. And then today, as it went up, they hadn't announced it in the initial PlayStation blog post, but there have been some slight changes that include some different HDR support and support for a 120 hertz monitor. So if you're someone who plays your PS5 on a PC monitor that supports that, you can now use those monitors differently. There will be also some updates to the PlayStation app, which I'm actually a heavy user of, and that I like some of these changes because they include actually having the ability to manage your PS5 console storage. So you can now not just download games, but actually deal with what's on your PS5 remotely, which is something the Xbox app has allowed you to do previously. But of course, this also leaves a lot of room for things that weren't added. I think some of the biggest things that people want are variable refresh rate, things like the M2 drive support that will essentially allow you to have expandable storage that meets the SSD requirements of the PS5, and more things on top of that. I reached out on Twitter to ask people, and we can dive into that. But generally, I wanted to throw to the three of you, and Brian, I'll start with you. We've talked before about firmware updates and things, and this is where we get into like the really nitty gritty of something that is like made a really big deal out of, but it's a lot of like underneath the surface stuff that you might not immediately notice. So I was curious at least to start, like, is anything here a really big change or addition you feel like is going to improve your PS5 experience, or is it kind of just same from here?
There was also a controller update, but I don't think anyone actually knows as of right now what was in there. It was just don't forget. So I'm excited to see how that can sort of evolve. But yeah, the storage thing is nice. I don't particularly know if I'll rush to take advantage of it yet, because I think I have like mild, like kind of just terror of overloading my PS5. It is just constantly warning me that there's too much stuff in there. So I keep it pretty slim as is. But I do appreciate that there's that option to just kind of have stuff on deck, because games are gigantic and the PS5 hard drive is tiny. And so it'll be nice to get something, like get a little bit of sort of control over that situation. Ultimately, like, that should have been rectified before the systems were even shipped. And hopefully it does if they ever do a revision. But for now, that's a nice little step. I'm into it.
And Lucy, how about for you? I remember when the PS5 came out, we were talking a lot about the changes to the UI. I think something I didn't realize was, like, a lot of people, at least like generally colloquially that I've seen, don't really like the UI these days. It feels like they, you know, after years of working toward a PS4 UI that everyone was pretty comfortable with, the PS5 UI is sort of starting from scratch a little bit. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I agree. I mean, I know this is, and people will probably get mad at me in the comments for saying this, I still really struggle with turning that thing off, like putting it like to rest. I still kind of like sort of hit the DualSense with a banana every time. Just like eventually I get to the rest mode option. I think that there are still plenty of improvements to come. I do want to shout out that the Zoom feature in particular was something that a lot of people were clamoring for, because the PS4 had it and the PS5 didn't ship with it. And it's, you know, one of those features that's really important for accessibility. So I like seeing PlayStation make strides towards making their console more accessible for users that may need it. Which is, you know, like, again, with all things accessibility, is most of us.
Absolutely. And yeah, just to specify exactly what that is for those who may not know, you can now adjust the magnification of the screen to suit your preference from the settings menu. And on that note, definitely want to shout out, Lucy, I believe you had commissioned and worked with freelancers to have accessibility reviews of the new consoles when those launched as well. And we're a few months out, but definitely go back and check those for, I think, a really interesting angle and a look at how important some of the features you may not think of if you don't have to use them are for these consoles.
Totally. And it's like, you know, we're very lucky these days that consoles are essentially works in progress. They're not like static things. So everything can constantly be iterated on and improved on. And it's good to see these companies have a growing focus on accessibility.
Absolutely. And Max, for you, are any of these changes, do they feel significant at all for you for how you play? Or are you kind of waiting for?
Not really. I'll check out the app. Yeah. But honestly, the app was always a thing I would mostly use if I was out of the house, which I don't really do anymore. I mean, it was always handy to be like, oh, I'll set something to download without having to go and turn on the PS5 and do all that. And it's nice to sort of do that, sort of send to your home PS4 or whatever. Yeah, as for the UI, like, I'm right there with Lucy. Like, there's a bunch of, like, the weird things where you swap between games and media with the triggers. I still hit that trying to go all the way to the right or left, you know, just hoping, like, which is what the, you know, the PS4 interface does. And then the whole switcheroo on you know, hitting the PlayStation button to get the power turned off, which just seems like a very odd choice, you know? Like, it's like that's, you know, that's like inverting camera controls. It's one of those things that I think it throws a lot of people for the loop, and, I don't know. I mean, I'm getting used to it, but the real thing is I hate turning off my PS5 because I'm having too much fun playing the games.
Great plug.
As for the hard drive stuff, I feel like I've fully gotten accustomed to treating that like a little game in and of itself. Like, it's basically the Resident Evil 4 briefcase, but with, you know, actual games. I'm just constantly shuffling it around and being like, ooh, like, do I want to delete Bloodborne again, or do I want to get rid of this, or like, oh, I guess I don't need to save any of these, you know, these video clips I accidentally captured by pushing the wrong button. Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. One thing that has come to my attention, and I feel like a complete, you know, able-bodied buffoon for bringing this up, but like in terms of accessibility, it is infuriating how many things could be like one-handed controller options that just aren't. Like part of the reason I bought that stupid media remote was hoping that it would make it easier to just be like, oh, I'm going to turn on my PlayStation and shuffle around through Netflix, because I don't necessarily want to take a two-handed controller and have to do that. It is flat out just frog stupid that on the YouTube app, to use the voice search, and I'm saying this as somebody who suddenly has to hold something very valuable with one hand, i.e. a baby, and don't necessarily have access, like if I'm trying to, you know, juggle a bottle and be like, I'm going to put on a video to keep me entertained while I'm being sleep deprived. To use the voice search on YouTube, which is awesome because it beats the hell out of using a little button, you know, button keyboard thing. You have to hit L2 and then everything else is done to select is with the face buttons, and then to navigate is with the left stick. And it seems to me like maybe you could have mapped the voice search to R2 and maybe let you navigate with the right stick and use the face buttons to interact. And you could do the entire thing with one hand. And it just seems like one of those really just, it could have been a very easy like swap thing. And this is across a lot of apps. And like, there's plenty of games too that like you could, I mean, you know, Disco Elysium is effectively a point and click game. You know, stuff like Persona is entirely turn-based. You're mostly just navigating menus aside from running around Shibuya Station. It's just, I don't know. It's something that never occurred to me because I am, you know, able-bodied, you know, person who typically is using both hands to use a controller. It's just, I don't know. It's just a weird thing that jumped out at me. So, I mean, I'd love to see Sony kind of jump on the same level that, you know, that Xbox is doing with that, you know, crazy modular controller.
Yeah, the adaptive controller has done a lot to move that stuff forward. But I think you're totally right in saying all that stuff. And to both your and Lucy's points, like, it is something that I think we're thinking about more and more. And as we continue to notice these things and think about these things more, I think it will drive both the people making those apps who have, you know, those choices, as well as the main platform holders, to build stuff in either on an app level or at a system level. And so I hope we continue to see updates like this. I think in terms of a usability thing, especially for longtime PlayStation people, you all are not alone. I know, Lucy, you were joking about you think people might get upset, but like, other than variable refresh rate, I think the thing most people responded to me on Twitter with was, can they just swap the hold versus press for turning off the console?
It's baked into our muscle memory from the PS4.
Yeah.
And I just like, it was such a weird switcheroo. Like, I'm like, why was that necessary? I would love to hear the explanation.
Yeah.
Because I just still haven't got used to it.
I understand that every time we bring this up, there's people in the comments being like, oh, it takes 2 seconds, just get over it. I get that. I totally understand that. But it's just like one of those very simple things that I wish they would just put the option in there for us, because it's something you do a lot. And it, for, you know, 7-8 years, we've been turning off our PS4s a certain way. And now we have to, there's like a second where your brain goes, oh yeah, that's right, that's not how that works there. Which I get it. It's not, there's far bigger problems in the world. You're on a video game YouTube channel. Okay. This is where you decided to fight your battles. I get it. But
you know, it takes 2 seconds to just not type a comment like that too. That's an option. Just put that out there.
I would like,
and it also
just
takes 2 seconds to give us a thumbs up. Don't forget to like and subscribe.
That's true. Well, Max said Xbox earlier, so I'm going to the comments to download the whole episode. No, it's just a little thing. And, you know, I see people tweeting about it all the time, and yeah, it's sort of frivolous and pointless, but I like it. And it's like, I don't know, it's a very simple thing that we've been doing for a very long time. The UI itself, I'm with you guys. It's definitely a little, like, it's one of those hyper minimalist streamlined things that actually causes more chaos than it does sort of usability. Or on paper, you look at it and you're like, oh, this is gorgeous and fluid and simplified. And I love that. But it's kind of like when Google redid their suite of apps, and you're just like, what is this rainbow garbage now? Like, I don't know what anything is anymore. Like, I went to download, I think it was like the HBO Max app on my PS5. And I was like, oh yeah, where do you guys hide that now? Like, it is just like subsections under subsections to get to just video apps and stuff like that. And I appreciate that the store isn't this whole thing now that you click over to and then it pinwheels for 45 seconds and you're like, are we doing it? Or like, can I spend money here or no?
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like it still has a long way to grow. And like Lucy said, like, it's very good that these systems aren't locked in on day one like they were for decades. Like, when you bought a console, that's the way it was. Or a Nintendo Switch. Like, that's basically been very, very simple, similar to how it's been since launch, which with very minor differences and additions here and there. But yeah, still, I'm happy to see it grow.
Still waiting on more than 2 themes for my Nintendo Switch.
Yeah.
If speaking of themes was a thing that I saw a lot of people ask for as well. I'm sort of split because I think unless they overhauled the PS5 UI a bit, because I think, Brian, to your point, like, they went for this really big, like, bold splash pages and really, like, more minimalist in terms of all the, like, accoutrement around it, but that also means each game as you're on that page is the focus. And so I don't know if themes have a place currently, but I also think, like, themes seem like an easy way to make a few extra bucks per game, and people who love them,
they're really so stupid, and I love them. Yeah. Like, I turn on my PS4, and I've got, like, the Untitled Goose Game theme, and I just, like, forgot I had so it, and I was just briefly like, oh, the goose is here! It doesn't just look like, you know, Netflix for Dark Souls, which is what the PS5 has, just swapping through and just...
I had the Bloodborne theme for my PS4, which was one of the best themes, I think, on the PS4. I loved it. It was so gorgeous and, like, cohesive across everything.
Yeah.
I would love that on my PS5.
Me too. I had the Platinum one and that the Platinum Bloodborne theme, and it wasn't even, like, a great... It's not even amazing looking. Like, the stock Bloodborne one is actually way better, but it was one of those things where it was, like, I could be in such a rut and turn on my PS4 and be like, oh, yeah, an accomplishment that I did once.
Yeah, no, they're a reminder of that stuff. Go ahead, Max. Sorry.
I was going to say, I had the Cyberpunk 2077 theme for, I want to say, 3.5 years. And then the game came out and then wasn't available for PS4. So, whoops.
Still not, you know,
It's still unavailable. Just that's our weekly segment. Cyberpunk still unavailable. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say really quick, have you guys noticed that, like, on the front page of the PS5, under, like, every game category, if you scroll down, like, half an inch, there are just, like, it's like user submitted content, and it's just like just really, like, sort of like horrendous children's thumbnails of, like, Twitch streams that they did. I don't feel like that information is necessarily pertinent to me as an old man. Like, I know some people look for that kind of stuff, but to me, it's just like you have this beautiful, sleek, minimalist console with this you know, clean UI, and you scroll down a half an inch and there's just this guy that's just like, I shot 40 bugs, and it's just like in all caps, and it's like those throw up font. It's great.
Those used to be buried way further down on the PS4, like you'd have to go through a few menus. And yeah, I think for me, like, there's a time and a place where I'm going to watch someone stream, and if I am, I'm probably just going to go over to the Twitch app. Like, I think if I own a game, the last thing I want to do is click over to that game and go, like, I'm not going to play this. I'm going to go watch someone else play this. Even though if I was going to go play the game, why would I be like, never mind? I think there's a lot more valuable information that could be put more immediately in your face about this stuff. And as you were all saying, like, there's a chance for things to be refreshed, but it is that, like, unfortunate give and take of, like, I'm glad of some changes, but I also wonder why they made some of these other changes. Like, for me, one of the updates here that is great, and it goes back to the storage thing, is you're now able to set sort of the level at which you want the game, every game, to capture and save images or videos for the trophies you acquire. So you don't have to just have your hard drive filled with, like, bronze trophy screenshots and videos that you'll never look at, which is great.
That's my experience, just a whole load of bronze.
Yeah, and having to, like, go delete all that stuff is such a waste of time. So I love that that's there. But a thing that a lot of people like myself who collect trophies pretty regularly hate is that now the way you look at them is all horizontally, whereas it used to be vertically. And as weird as that sounds, it, like, demonstrably makes it a more difficult and annoying experience to sort through. Because it used to be so much more smooth to just go down that list, but now it's this weird give and take where you can only see maybe like 3 or 4 trophies at a time. It's one of those things that I wish would be changed now, but as you all were saying, like, this is going to be a in change progress that we'll see over time. But it's especially when there's only a few million people versus 100 million on PS4 and PS5, it's going to be interesting as more people adopt the console and where we get to at that point.
This episode of Podcast Beyond is brought to you by NordVPN, a great way to protect yourself online while also improving your overall experience while enjoying cyberspace. Are you tired of streaming shows, movies, or sporting events being unavailable in your region due to draconian restrictions that are based on completely arbitrary geographical boundaries in physical meat space? Well, switch your virtual location to a place where that's no longer an issue. The same goes for shopping. You can get the best possible deal on subscriptions, flights, hotels, and other goods and services like that from websites that like to play favorites with certain territories and currencies. Meanwhile, encrypted traffic protects your data from hackers, viruses, malware, phishing sites, and other harmful hitchhikers of the information superhighway. Though really, it's more of an information autobahn, because there is no speed limit with NordVPN. It is the fastest VPN in the world, so there won't be any buffering or lagging, and it'll stop your ISP from throttling your bandwidth. Isn't that nice? One NordVPN account can be used across 6 devices, which is great. My wife has been using our account to watch all sorts of awful British reality TV shows that aren't available here, like Argument Island or Half Naked Idiots Fall in Love, and everyone's favorite, The Worst People Just Got Married. Let's hear them talk about it. Shows that are so bad they're blocked in our part of the world for our own good, but luckily, NordVPN allows her to trick the internet into thinking she's in the UK so she and her awful friends can shriek and howl and cackle at the TV while I'm trying to relax. I've been using my VPN too. You know what I've been using it for? None of your business. Yep, that's right. And thanks to NordVPN, my data is safely encrypted, all bundled up in a weighted security blanket of incomprehensibly complex math problems, and nobody can tell what it's doing under there. Data, you do your thing. I'll leave you alone. 1 month of NordVPN coverage costs less than a cup of coffee. Coffee can't protect you from cybercriminals unless you throw it at them or pour it on their computers, and you'll probably get in trouble for doing that. So get NordVPN instead. To get the best possible discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/pobeyond. That link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Again, that is nordvpn.com/pobeyond. And now, back to the show. The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. You know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line thanks to Visible. When you switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible, you can get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees. No, really. You can look around for them. They're not there. Switch now at Visible.com. Save on wireless without the hassle. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Unless there's any other major changes that anyone saw that stood out to you, figured we could move on from there because there is a bit of a interesting behind the scenes PlayStation discussion to have. And that is
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, there is a report that broke last week from Bloomberg and Jason Schreier that I highly recommend reading through the full report of it. And there's definitely been some talk after the fact of it, and we can get into that as well. But this big report was essentially a look at sort of the behind the scenes machinations of some of the projects we may and may not see at PlayStation, and how I'm going to crib my own writing, but essentially Sony's reliance on its biggest blockbusters and the games that are too big to fail versus anything else. And so the report goes into things like that secret Sony studio that we've been talking about for years that many people assumed was working on an Uncharted game. According to Schreier's report, that group, which was at the Visual Arts Service Group in Sony, that has normally sort of been the pinch hitter to help other studios and come in and assist them across the finish line. This 30-strong development group, apparently at the time, was working on a remake of The Last of Us, The Last of Us 1. they were working on that remake, but however, the team was reportedly running into trouble, one, about their existence being kept a secret, and then allegedly Sony not offering extra budget or time and focus to help the project see through. Eventually, according to the report, and again, this is all allegedly, Sony has not confirmed or commented on any of this. Herman Holst reportedly deemed the project too expensive in this new studio's hands and wanted instead that team to be focusing on support for the development of The Last of Us Part 2. And then allegedly this project was moved into Naughty Dog and it has since effectively become Naughty Dog's project. In addition to that, we learned that on the Sony Bend side, and these are the two big ones that I want to focus on, Sony Bend, after Days Gone was released, had been pitching a sequel and reportedly working on one. That project was reportedly rejected, according to the report, and then Sony allegedly then moved Bend onto two Naughty Dog-related projects, both a multiplayer game and a new Uncharted, but that caused people at the studio reportedly to be so concerned that they would essentially be consumed into Naughty Dog proper and sort of lose their own identity, that some people left, some people asked to be taken off the project, then they eventually were taken off of it and are working on a new game, but Days Gone 2, at least at the time, was deemed too much of a risk to take, even though the game was allegedly profitable, according to the Bloomberg report. That is a lot of detail, but I sort of wanted to get the top level stuff out of the way. It is also, of course, worth mentioning that on the note of Days Gone, after the fact, Jeff Ross, who previously was at the studio and appeared on David Jaffe's live stream slash YouTube channel, was talking about the report itself and couldn't confirm too much because of non-disclosure agreements. He did say that the original pitch from the team was that they wanted it to be a co-op experience with some larger shared world elements. So doing something a little bit more expansive and taking the idea of these freaker hordes and the world they've created and making a co-op experience. So we can get into the nitty-gritty of what Days Gone 2 would have been in a little bit. But I think let's start with the overarching Last of Us remake of it all and the lack of faith in this alleged team to make it and then move it over to Naughty Dog. There are so many places to go, and I guess I'll start with the Last of Us remake itself. And Lucy, I want to start with you. Just a Last of Us remake seems like a strange choice to go immediately toward, I think, for a lot of people, especially a new team's first project.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I understand the sort of pros and cons of investing in a Last of Us remake. I understand how it could work. For example, if you were going to remake The Last of Us and have like a PS5 Last of Us Part 2, PS5 version of The Last of Us and package that all in a single thing, all boosted and upgraded, that makes a lot of sense to me. Like, that's just kind of like, yeah, I can see there being a place for that particular product. But I completely agree with Dorno, you wrote a piece recently and shot a video, an opinion piece about how the whole report in general, including this Last of Us remake news, really paints a picture of Sony being very risk averse. Yeah. And to me, The Last of Us, our Last of Us remake is really not needed in the grand scheme of things that a first-party studio could be doing. The game is, 8 years old? It's already had a remaster that was really good. You know, The Last of Us 2 came out very recently. It's like a nice to have, but not a need to have. And so the fact that there were resources... and first party resources being put towards this remake is odd to me. It definitely didn't feel like we needed that. And it would have been nice. I mean, it would be nice across the board to see some more experimentation and new IP coming from Sony's first party stable.
Yeah, absolutely. And, Brian, I'll throw to you next. It's a curious one to me, and as Lucy had mentioned, I wrote a piece about it. I think it's the report shows that it's emblematic of them being risk averse. Of course, them wanting to make sure a Last of Us remake gets handled properly is not a risk in any way. I, as Lucy said, I can absolutely see from a top level executive money making reasoning of like, this is one of our most successful franchises ever. It's one of our most critically well received franchises. The TV show is coming out and that'll introduce it to a whole new audience. This all makes sense, but it is part of a larger picture that I think is a little bit concerning.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think as if you look at like these sort of like AAA in-house studios that Sony is aligned with, they ultimately have a finite amount of resources and games that they can, you know, conceivably create in our lifetime. And I don't really think a Last of Us remake was at the top of anybody's list in terms of, you know, things we would demand or want. I mean, even if you look at the stable of PlayStation exclusive and PlayStation adjacent franchises, there are so many more, you know, sort of vintage, awesome games that could really benefit from a modernized coat of paint rather than something like The Last of Us. That said, you know, devil's advocate, Last of Us 2 added a ton of combat options. That game is like incredibly fun to play when you really kind of use all the parts. And so that would be cool to throw in there. But I think this speaks to a larger issue that a lot of the general public and a lot of gamers in general don't necessarily have the patience to go back and play something that's even 8 or 9 years old. Like, it's, to me, it's unfathomable because I'm capable of doing those things. I know a lot of people are able to do those things, but I games age weirdly. And I think a lot of people don't really want to play a game from 8 or 9 years ago. Or there's this understanding that games have to be cutting edge and stunning and unlike anything you've ever seen before. And to push this new show and get millions of people watching on this prestige pay for cable network, you're all of a sudden going to get a bunch of people going, oh, so this is based on a game? Which game? And they're like, oh, it's this game from 8 or 9 years ago. And then they see it and they're like, well, that doesn't look as good as a game that came out this year. And that's kind of a bummer to me. Like, I wish we would sort of collectively escape that cage of having to make sure that every video game is cutting edge and the most beautiful thing ever, because otherwise we won't take the time to consume the story. So I see it both ways. I completely understand why, from a business perspective, they would want to have a new version of this classic game out. And I think I can call something classic when it's, you know, almost a decade old, or would be by the time this TV show comes out.
Just don't call it an instant classic, which is a phrase I absolutely hate.
What is that even? Yeah.
Makes no sense.
Like, you haven't even died. Like, this is the best sandwich I've ever eaten. And it's like, you give it a minute. Like, see what it does to your insides. Maybe you have regrets later. So I don't know. I understand why they have to do this, or why they want to do this. I wish this wasn't the priority. I would rather a new story or a new game, or multiple new games, as it seems this almost cannibalized, you know? That's kind of where I am on it.
Yeah, Max, sorry, I saw you were just about to go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, to echo everyone else here, I think, like, just it all feels kind of samey, you know? Like, hearing that it's a remake or a remaster or a redo, even the fact that the HBO show is a retelling of the first game. I mean, obviously they're going to change some stuff, but, like, I was sort of hoping that it would expand that universe and do some different corner of that. Like, we've seen, I feel like the more... the larger universes out there in terms of sort of, you know, transmedia fiction or whatever they call it these days, that's what it does, is it sort of fleshes out different corners. Like, you don't see, you know, there's not like a Disney Plus show that's like retelling the events of A New Hope in show form. Like, that would be weird. You know, like, every Walking Dead show is kind of fleshing out one corner of that. And it seems kind of odd that the jump between, you know, games and a TV show is doing that. And then to sort of need to cash in on that by, I mean, again, this is totally, totally theoretical, but the first thing that popped into my head when I heard about this idea of this being a Last of Us remake would be basically reskinning, you know, Joel with Pedro Pascal, like making it line up with the aesthetics of the HBO show, and trying to have effectively a very, very AAA, very polished licensed game from the license holder. Is it still a licensed game if it's like the people who own it or make, like, you know what I mean? Like, normally, like, a licensed game is like,
I think they have to call it The Last of Us, the TV show, the game.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, that's such a weird thing to me. And then wasn't there also talk in that article about like an Uncharted remake or reboot or.
Yeah. So I'll bring up the specifics, and this gets into the larger parts of it all. And let me pull up the full thing. But essentially there was word that, and sorry, my links are going everywhere. An IGN video I could watch. How perfect. The part about Uncharted was that Bend, when they essentially couldn't go forward with Days Gone 2, seemed to be working with Naughty Dog on multiple projects, one being a multiplayer thing, which we assume is sort of a follow-up to the Last of Us Factions, and then as well as a new Uncharted. But a lot of the Bend developers allegedly feared that they might be absorbed into Naughty Dog, and the studio's leadership asked to be taken off the Uncharted project. And they are now working on a new game of their own. So it's unclear what the status of that Uncharted project was. Of course, it's really interesting to note that this mystery team that ended up allegedly working on that Last of Us remake, most people assumed for a long time the rumors were that they were working on Uncharted.
Right.
So it all comes back to it eventually.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if, like, with Sony sort of trying to throw their kind of their crown jewel, you know, first party gaming properties into a different medium and try to get like a more mainstream appeal with, you know, with movies and TV. Like, it totally makes sense to have something enticing that looks like that to kind of lure people over onto the gaming side. Like, if they're, you know, more casual people who, you know, their first exposure to The Last of Us is an HBO show, or their first look at Uncharted is a Tom Holland movie. I kind of get that, but it just gives me an icky feeling. Again, it's totally like a weird gut feeling, but like, I hope that that's not what they're doing. Like, I hope that they're, you know, not trying to basically, I guess I don't know what you'd call them. Just try to make more try to make their games line up with their adaptations of their games. Like, that's just a weird.
Yeah, the thing is, like, and this is, you know, this it's pretty easy to say this, but I feel like, had they gone with an approach of making the TV show a story that's sort of adjacent to what's happening in the game, or focus on new characters, that gives the opportunity to make a new game based on new characters. And I feel like that's such a win-win for everybody, rather than like you're chasing this bizarre loop of making a show based on a game and then needing to make a game that you know, feeds into that show so that this consumers are spending money in a circle. It, like, we're looking at if you're watching the video, we're watching, looking at footage of like some fairly old at this point Uncharted games, or a couple of them. Games age weird, right? It's bizarre. Like, you could hypothetically remake your favorite game every 10 years for the rest of your life, just chasing the sort of, you know,
the perfect version.
Yeah, the uncanny valley of it all, right? The perfect version of it, and you'll never truly catch it, because that's just the way that works. Something Max mentioned, we had talked about this in a video last week about the potential of them reskinning Joel and Ellie to be based on, you know, the characters in the TV show. I find that to be such a, like, just horrible potential idea. If you look at the backlash that happened when the Spider-Man remastered game came to PS5 and they reskinned, you know, Peter Parker's character, recast him, everything like that. It's a lot of backlash there. Like, people, I don't think people really understand. I mean, if you're listening to the show, you understand. If you're a casual person watching HBO, maybe not. Joel and Ellie are two of the most iconic characters to ever come from this medium, like the medium of video games. Like, having them cast as different people on a TV show is one thing, but looping back to the game and skinning them to be actors, when, like, Joel and Ellie were two of the most defining examples of, like, this is what this medium can do when it puts on its, like, big boy pants and tries to tell, like, a Hollywood style story. Like, these are characters that have made people cry. Like, these are, like, really important characters to a lot of people. And I feel like just swapping them out with actors from a TV show is, like, doing a tremendous disservice to what games have accomplished as a storytelling and narrative medium from the jump.
Altano, I totally agree with you, but was that ever seriously floated?
No,
I
mean, no,
like, it's just been one of the, yeah.
Just for anyone.
No, unwarranted fear currently.
Yeah, we are preemptively angry at something that isn't even remotely confirmed to be true. And I'm getting it out of my system now, so when it does happen in a couple months, I can sit in, like, a old reclining chair and be like, I was there at the beginning.
We can just roll the clip.
Just watching this clip. Yeah. Over, yeah, and over, exactly. And over.
We'll be on a talk show and we could just be like, and play that back. I mean, thank you.
The underlying thing here is, like, both in terms of seeing games that I've already played sort of remade or rehashed or whatever, and also seeing games adapted into movies, it's more of the same. You know, like, it's not, the fact is, this is a cutting edge medium, and this is a effectively limitless space that's also, you know, prohibitively expensive to get too crazy with. And I feel like, you know, games are trying to kind of rein it in and be like, how do we produce a cutting edge AAA video game that both attracts a wide new audience but pleases the fans, and it also comes in under budget and ahead of schedule and doesn't kill the developers in the process? How do we do that? Like, that's a big question. And to do it with kind of an unproven franchise or IP, that's you know, considerably riskier than doing it with, you know, the game that sold, the last five games sold a million units, or, like, the, you know, the last two iterations were, you know, huge successes, aside from all the angry comments on the second one. You know, like, it makes sense to be, like, you know, to kind of to play it safe, but at the same time, it's sort of disappointing on that level, in the same way that it's disappointing to hear that the HBO show is not going to tread new territory or do anything new and crazy. It's sort of going to be like a remix.
Yeah, well, they're going to take some creative liberties with some stuff. Like, some stuff will be a little bit different. But then again, like, will that be reflected in the video game adaptation? Will there be two different, like, story versions of The Last of Us, where, like, I'm talking to a friend and I'm like, have you played The Last of Us? And they're like, yeah, I can't believe Pedro Pascal killed Ellie. I'm like, what?
I'm trying to think if there's any other times we don't know if this is going to happen, but, like, the only other version of this that I can think of, and I could be wrong here, is Street Fighter the movie the game?
Yeah.
Like, have we seen, like, a thing like this before?
I mean, the Lego movie the game, but other than that.
But, like, but, you know, just to, because I did actually hold that interview with Neil Druckmann.
I was just about to say, yeah.
About that, the HBO adaptation.
Yeah.
And, you know, he didn't, he certainly didn't say this is going to be a straight up, like, beat for beat adaptation. It is, yes, it is the first game, but in a very broad sense. So there's a lot of stuff that is going to be very different, a lot of stuff that's going to be very new, a lot of stuff that's potentially going to introduce a whole bunch of other stuff in the Last of Us universe. Because, of course, you know, no one would just be like, we want one season of this thing. Like, yeah. You know, the whole idea is to explore this universe and expand upon it. So, after chatting with him, I really got the vibe that this is kind of a launching point.
Yeah.
And there's going to be, you know, the occasional line that people will recognize. Obviously, the characters are recognizable, but it's certainly not, a doggedly faithful adaptation.
Yeah, I think as you were speaking to him, one of the things Neil said was that some of his favorite stuff that they've been doing is the stuff that is completely new and doesn't mm-hmm. just go beat for beat for the show. And you're completely right, Lucy. Like, they don't want to set that show up to be a one and done season. Like, you know, HBO knows what they got out of Game of Thrones, the ending season aside. Like, they have potential, and it is much easier to spin around another season of a show versus a sequel to The Last of Us. And so there is the, like, whether or not the, because as you were saying, like, the reskinning of the characters thing, I think that aside, I understand the remake nature of wanting to do that, especially to line up and comfortably have something there alongside the show, excuse me. And I think, as you all were noting, like, there's enough advancements in the AI and the stealth and all the gameplay of The Last of Us Part Two that the one critique most people had of the first The Last of Us was, like, the gunplay and the stealth was just kind of there. And mm-hmm. so to match it up to The Last of Us Part Two would be awesome. And I would, you know, cynically very much like to play that. But I think bringing it back into what this whole report was trying to show was that if, you know, a new studio doing that can't quite get the funding that they want to, if Days Gone, after being profitable, can't have a sequel because it didn't necessarily review amazingly out of the gate, but had a very strong support for it from the fan base afterward. If those things can't succeed from a company that, you know, produced games like Parappa the Rapper and Gravity Rush and things like that, like, where we see these weird offshoots in between the big games. You know, one of the things I said in my op-ed was, like, you know, The Last of Us was kind of a risk when it first happened. Like, did people want an extremely serious, you know, macabre third-person action game that explored, you know, the meaning of family and life and death in this post-apocalypse? Or could a God of War revival that was mostly focused around a father and son story that was very cinematically purposed work as well? You know, those are risks within established franchises or established ideas, because Naughty Dog had the Uncharted framework. But even Uncharted comes from a studio that made mascot platformers. You know,
I keep saying I want Crash Bandicoot's divorce, the game. I want the marriage story with the Bandicoot. I want it to be.
I thought you wanted a realistic Crash Bandicoot where it was just a little, like,
Lucy, I don't know what I want.
Bandicoot with a little pair of underwear on. I've never forgotten that.
I want the real life Bandicoot. I want a JPEG of a real life Bandicoot that you play as and jump around. But no, I like it. Sorry, go ahead, Lucy.
Well, I'm sort of interrupting you, Dorno, and I apologize, but I'm just aggressively agreeing with everything that you're saying. And I do want to touch on Days Gone. I don't want to, you know, gloss over that.
For sure, yeah.
In favor of The Last of Us remake, because for me, that was more of a bummer. And I know that this sounds very rich coming from someone who did not score the original highly when I reviewed it back whenever it was.
You gave it, what, like a six something?
I think I gave it a 6.8.
Yeah, that means
it was a little bit under almost a seven.
I mean, it's not like you gave it a 2 out of 10 and tanked the studio. Like, let's.
I mean, you know, it's weird because I haven't reviewed anything in so long. Like, because my job at IGN completely changed, and I just don't have time to review anything. And it's since the Days Gone conversation started happening, I got some hate on my Instagram, and that's when I know that people are really mad at me, because people can tweet at me all day long and I'm like, I've got a quality filter, I don't really see it. But when someone comes onto, like,
the photography website,
a video of me, like, looking at a pig, yeah. Which is what they commented on, being like, New Zealand. I'm like, okay, wow, that's right. People are really, like, really upset at me about that review score. But I do want to note that in my review, I did say that there was a good game in here somewhere, and, like, really did highlight what I thought was the most original and biggest selling point of the game, which was the horde system, which I still think is remarkable and amazing and could have been utilized more in the original. I didn't think that the world itself was particularly interesting, but again, this is all stuff that could be improved upon, right? Like it wasn't like, oh, this was such a stinker. This is beyond redeemable.
Right.
There were so many interesting systems at play that were just incredibly rough around the edges. And yeah, I have had some hate from people, saying, why are you being all thoughtful now when you sort of stoned it at the time? And it's like, well, I didn't actually stone it at the time. I thought it had a great deal of potential. And it's sort of like, remember when Assassin's Creed first came out and it was so rough around the edges and didn't feel fully realized.
I was just going to say.
Then Assassin's Creed 2 came along and it was the fully realized version of that. And I thought that there was so much in Days Gone that could have been built upon and improved upon, and it could have been that great franchise, you know?
Why?
And so I was really bummed out that the sequel was canned.
Yeah, why build this groundwork? Why spend 7 years building the groundwork to this game? The studio is working on this for a very long time. Like, architecturally, this game is awesome. Like, mechanically, it's fun as hell. I thought it was, like, rough around the edges in terms of, like, story. It was the pacing and the sort of, like, overall kind of bloated feel to it. Like, I understand that they felt like they needed to put a lot of content in there. But just like you said, the first Assassin's Creed game, that's, like, a 6.8, 7 out of 10. But imagine if Ubisoft just been like, well, reviewers and fans didn't connect with this the way we wanted it to. We were going to bring the franchise out back and shoot it in the head. Like, that's crazy to me. Like, the fact that Ubisoft invested in that series and the developers and attributed it to all of their sort of entire portfolio of worldwide studios attempting to revitalize it every year, grow it, evolve it. Like, that's a franchise it's taken on, and it's gone in so many different directions since then. And that could have happened here and should happen here. Like, this is something that no one should give up on. Like, it's
the
sucks.
Weird thing is, like, I mean, how many types of cola does Pepsi sell? They have Pepsi. They don't have, like, RC Cola under the hood, too. Like, they have their one flagship cola. I feel like in this case, this is like, you know, the Days Gone is another zombie game. Don't call them zombies, though, you know, alongside The Last of Us, which is also a zombie game where you call them clickers. They're not the same thing. And they feature, you know, like a grizzled protagonist with the scratchy beard. And it's sad because they have lost a loved one or whatever. And mechanically, they're night and day. I actually prefer Days Gone across the board, but it is like, so similar. I mean, in terms of like what it is as a piece of media, like it's a third person game where you shoot zombies and you survive in the post-apocalypse. And I can totally see why, you know, if, you know, Sony had to look at, okay, one of these has to go. It's like, well, The Last of Us is clearly like that's the successful one. That's the one everyone loves. And I'd love to see them try to build a Last of Us game in this engine. That would be phenomenal. It'd be really interesting. But I totally get why, you know, it at the end of the day, like, you know, this isn't like Assassin's Creed. This isn't like a unique universe. This is kind of this is another zombie game. There's a lot of them. And I kind of get why Sony would be like, maybe it's not worth the investment. I don't know.
I get it. But I'm also like, there was something. I keep coming back to the hordes. Like, there was something so cool about that technology. And, you know, I mean, obviously what they were pitching, if the report was true, was very different to a single player experience. It was a co-op shared world sort of thing. And maybe that's, you know, another reason why Sony was like, well, that's not, you know, something we're interested in. But I just do think that there was enough there and like there was just enough built that could have been improved upon in a way that was really remarkable, that leaned a little more into the horror and thrill side of Days Gone.
I mean, I wish that Days Gone had been, if it had been more like, I don't know, more fun. If it had been more like, hey, it's the end of the world. Let's go. Like, again, they gave you, you got a backwards hat and a rocket motorcycle. That's like inherently fun stuff, but you're still playing as this scruffy, sad bastard who wore a vest to his own wedding. Like, it's just maybe Naughty Dog could be doing the serious, sad zombie stuff. And then Days Gone could be like, school's out, everybody. Motorcycle time. Like, let's woohoo. Let's have a good one.
I think.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say, I understand them worried about being, or hypothetically being worried about having like too many
sort of like of their in-house IPs be similar, right? You've got this scruffy, you know, post-apocalyptic zombie game. I think like what kind of messes me up though is like, had they taken this team off of this game and put them on something brand new or tasked them with doing something brand new, that'd be one thing. But to kind of look at your stable and hypothetically say, hey, we have too many games that are similar, that's why you should remake one of them, and also maybe make like the sixth Uncharted game or fifth Uncharted game, not counting the card one. Like that to me is like, it's not like this is a team that was, you know, getting pushed into a bold new direction and being told to go create some brand new IP that's different than anything else they're doing. Like if you look at something like Horizon, that's very clearly like the Killzone team was like, so what's next? Let's really just go. Let's deviate from what we're known for.
Let's go nuts.
You know, let's go bonkers. And instead we get, you know, like we're going to get a remake of a game that has already been remastered, and then potentially the fifth or sixth Uncharted game. Like that's kind of a bummer to me.
Yeah, I think the thing, just to speak to everyone, because I think you're all making a lot of really valid points about like the state of all this stuff. It is, I think, Lucy, to your point, like the thing that bums me out the most is like the potential of the Horde stuff that they were doing, the work they put into building a like very like thorough relationship of the character to a vehicle as well. Like there's enough there that I could also see why they were thinking of like, oh yeah, a co-op biker gang in a post-apocalyptic zombie world. You could make that work. And I think there is so much potential there that I wish we could see. And I hope that the work that they did on all this stuff can be applied to a new world and a new universe. Max, I get your point very much of like from a like pulled back marketing standpoint of talking to a mass audience of 100+ million PS4 owners to be like, here are two zombie games that aren't zombies, but here are the differences, and have to get into the nitty gritty. You start to lose the elevator pitch that you can sell people on easily. My only thing with that is like the signs of that were there kind of from day one. I feel like when we first saw Days Gone, everyone was like, oh, another zombie game from the first party Sony stable. And like, right. I think there should have been enough realization that if that was the concern, they probably could have deviated from the course and let them use the work that they were building to make this world and do something different. Sorry, I was just going to say, just to wrap up, like my hope is, and I get that the worry from the team is, because at the end of the day, even if the critical success wasn't there, the commercial success did seem to be there. The audience did gravitate to it. There is a very, very dedicated Days Gone audience out there within the PlayStation base. It sold well enough. It you know, the Bloomberg report said it was profitable. It's one of those things that like, It's a bummer to me also that the studio may not get to continue what they were clearly passionate about, but then also to kind of have their next steps be taken away from them and be like, here's this other studio's work that we need you to work on. If that is all the case, again, this is all allegedly. We are only seeing a bit of the picture here. I do want to emphasize that, like, we know, especially because I'm sure there are potentially Sony devs out there who may hear some of this discussion, like, we know we do not have a full understanding of the situation.
Exactly. There are so many, like, politics and deals and moneyed things that we've got no clue about, and this is purely based.
There are some things we know what we're talking about, and some instances where we are just frightened animals, and this is a little bit of both, you know.
Yes, yeah, I think that is an excellent way to put it. But yeah, it is. I think the thing for me and the thing that I essentially put a lot of like what my ethos was in my op-ed was something that, and I don't know how many of you saw this, but like the day this report broke, there was a Sean Layden piece of an E3 speech that he gave like 6 years ago, where he was talking about Viv Ribbon and how it went against the grain and wasn't afraid to be ambitious. And that was the Sony mantra, and was like these risks and creating something new was what Sony could be. And I think like seeing that clip juxtaposed with doubling down on a remake of a beloved game that we all just played a sequel of, along with studios maybe having to work on other existing projects because their new projects can't take off. And then coupled with Sony Japan being shrunk essentially to Team Asobi and not having the ability to also have the Team Eco team within it, the Gravity Rush team, the, you know, three or four other teams. It's just that worrying thing of, and this is sort of where I like, you know, wrapped everything up, was like, I can't wait for the sequels we're getting. I like totally hypocritically, I cannot wait for the next Spider-Man, the next Horizon, the next God of War. I cannot wait for those things. But at the end of the day, a lot of those things, you know, maybe Spider-Man aside, were born from risks. Horizon was a risk for the Killzone team to take, even if Killzone was getting a bit long in the tooth. But like a new God of War that wasn't like the old God of Wars was a risk for that team to take and to work on for so many years. I want there to still be room for those risks is, I think, at the end of the day, the biggest thing that we won't really know until a few years from now what Sony is doing.
And Duno, also to your point, like, the report said that there was a lack of marketing support around Dreams and a lack of kind of internal holding that engine up as something incredibly special, which I think out of all of what was spoken about in that report, that was the one that kind of made me the most sad, because, you know, Dreams is remarkable and it was in development for years and years and years and years and years. To hear that it wasn't properly supported, again, allegedly, is such a bummer. Because it was, you know, PlayStation has been synonymous with risk-taking. For years, it was the risky, the far more riskier player in the sort of the console race between Xbox and PlayStation. And that's what I always thought, you know. It was a risk taker, and to sort of hear that it's Sony is playing things safe and that's the kind of internal vibe, is a real bummer. And I hope that changes. I mean, this is just a moment in time, you know. There's plenty, PlayStation will continue to evolve as it has. But I do want to see those risks taken again.
I got a risk for you. They should make microtransactions in Dreams. You want to add a square? It's $4.
I was going to go the opposite direction. Feathers?
$200.
They announced recently that they're investing significant money into the studio that made Dreams. So that's good, right? Like they are. Mm-hmm. It's not like they're shutting that down. I also truly believe that that's the kind of game that will continue to see extended life when it becomes more accessible to people. Like I we've said this for a very long time, but making that sort of like a stock software on the PS5 is the best thing you could possibly do. Just put that, put Dreams out for free for everyone, even make it a PlayStation Plus game, make it one of the, you know, the PS Plus collection, just put it in there, give people the option to play it. I think like that's the problem with that game was always like, you know, what am I actually doing and where do I start and who, you know, how do I access, like, what is this? You know, they had a tough time selling that. The Sean Layden thing was fascinating to me. My favorite part of it was when he said it wasn't a million seller, but that wasn't the point. Yeah. Like to me, that is the most important thing that somebody in a position like him can say, because it shows you that there is opportunity underneath this company to make smaller, more intimate, risky, you know, and strange avant-garde projects that aren't necessarily, you know, multi-million sellers. They aren't necessarily grizzled AAA first party stabbing games. Like there's cool, weird art indie stuff in there too. And I think that they'll find that again. We had sort of heard, you know, like off the record from a couple people over the last few years that Sony had been sort of pulling away from funding independent projects. We saw that a lot in the beginning of the PS4 era, where they were really helping a lot of small studios bring their games to the finish line, putting in significant funds and stuff like that. And it seems like they pulled away from that because ultimately, like for business, that's not the smartest thing in the world, is to give a small studio, you know, millions of dollars to barely break even. But I do think that that is part of sort of telling the story about a console and creating a narrative of what the PlayStation brand represents. Like it's not to me just the big games. I know we're going to get those. I know PS5 is going to have an awesome year. I know it's probably having even better next year. But I do love when those smaller things are kind of peppered in here and there. We do get Returnal soon, which is cool. That's, you know, Housemarque got to do their own thing there. I love that. There's a bunch of cool smaller games that are sort of coming underneath the PlayStation umbrella at some point. But I do worry that it's just going to be a focus on just the biggest stuff. And that is worrisome in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's the potential, and obviously we've seen it with Shuhei in his new role of focusing on indies, and we've seen, I want to say, a more regular cadence of PlayStation indie drops and, like, announcements and things. And maybe that's how they're mitigating the risk, is they're putting it on the developers who are already doing this stuff rather than internally. And, you know, over time, that strategy may makes sense. But, you know, to your point, Brian, as you were saying, like, at the end of the day, all this stuff is a business and we can't ignore the business realities around it. But I think the reason that that Layden quote rang true with so many people was because at least like the risk of business there, there was some understanding that art had a place in there as well. And you know, the worry, I think, is that the pretense of art having a place where risk can be taken is going to fall away. And it's just going to be the biggest blockbusters and the biggest hits that have to succeed no matter what. And without those risks, that's, you know, those risks are how you get those bigger franchises eventually. So I think the hope is that we see a return to that in some case, but yeah, as we've all been saying, like things in the short term, you know, there was a lot of doom and gloom when this report came out. Things in the short term for Sony, we're going to see some big games. It's going to be a big first couple of years for the PS5. I have no doubt about like we're going to have a lot of really, really great, awesome games to talk about in the next couple, you know, 12 to 18 months. What comes after, though, is a big question. And we'll have to track that stuff as it happens. Other than that, though, I did want to move on to talk a little bit about what we've been playing. Excuse me. And Max, I want to start with you since we haven't gotten here. What have you been playing / have you had time to play things?
I've gotten to play a fair amount because babies don't do much besides sleep and throw up and stuff. But yeah, I gave Persona 5 Royal another shot. I got about 20 hours in, maybe. I got a good chunk of the way. I've a little bit further than I was last time. Actually, no, I think I got to exactly where I was last time, which is the beginning of the art gallery stuff. And that game is really hard to go into after playing Yakuza 7, I'll be honest, because it gets hailed as like a, you know, a magnificent art JRPG, but I feel like it has a lot more visual novel going for it. It's just sort of weird to be like, and I know this has been, I think I've said this before, it's beautiful, it's incredible, it's incredibly well made, but it's like if you go into it, I don't know, if you go into expecting a certain amount of freedom, it's not quite there, you know, like it's a lot about it's more about like, you know, working within a schedule, like it's fairly structured. But it's funny to me because when I was a teenager, I had all the time in the world and I would use it to watch all the episodes of Dragon Ball Z or whatever. Like I would, you know, tape Toonami every day. Like time was meaningless because I got off school at 3:30. And now as an adult, time is fleeting. And it's weird to play a video game that takes 120 hours and 12 of those are to get through the tutorial. And then you'll be like, all right, I'm finally to the good part. All right, it's nighttime. I want to go have an adventure. I want to go to the, you know, I want to go eat the big hamburger. And then my cat goes, hey, I got a big day tomorrow. I was like, I have a big day tomorrow in real life. Like, let me play the video game. I got 15 minutes free. What are you doing, you stupid cat? Anyway, aside from that, I also jumped into Disco Elysium, which is phenomenal. I really love that game. I heard all of the nonstop praise that it got when it was on PC. And I said, that PC is for typing on. I'm not playing games on there. And no, I got a good chunk of the way into that. I'm not sure how much I have left. I actually have no idea how long that game is, but I'll keep chipping away at that. It is, good Lord, it is bleak and clever and really just, I don't know what I was expecting, but that it is so nice to play something that is, speaking of too many things being familiar, it is like so nice to jump into a game that is like not like anything else I've played. Totally doing its own thing. And then we also we noted that, what is it, Final Fantasy 14 is doing its PlayStation 5 beta/free trial right now.
Yes.
And
yeah,
Jonathan, I think we both agreed that are you checking it out?
I spent about an hour creating a character and then I was like, well,
and then you went to bed.
Yeah. And then I was like, well, I'm kind of tired right now and I wasn't feeling too great. So I was like, I'll play this later. So yeah, I'm totally down to do a sort of beyond guild for this.
Yeah. I hit level 8 last night.
Okay.
Like I'm giving it a shot. I made a horrible little boy. His name is Travis Buffnut and he's a little
nice
redhead with a mullet and he's got earrings and he's got rosy cheeks and he likes to hop around. He's got an axe.
It's horrible.
It's horrible.
I love
actually,
it.
Actually, I try to make a character named Ricky Porno, but it wouldn't allow me to type those words into the. So I'm taking it seriously. It's weird because I don't know. I've never gotten into an MMO, and I feel like there's a reason for that. But I'm giving it a shot and being like, I'll, you know, give it a fair shake and see what happens. Because I've seen adult men cry over this game.
Yeah,
I need to. Like speaking of the effusive praise that we've all heard for Disco, I feel like I hear that with FF14 every time a new expansion comes out. It's like the legions of fans are just like, this is not just the best MMO ever, it's the best Final Fantasy, it's the best RPG, right? You have to play it. So this feels like the time to get into it if there ever was.
Okay, well, I'm going to join you guys.
Yeah.
I'm saying it now because I love Final Fantasy. I've played all the, you know, the big PlayStation Final Fantasy installments. And this is the kind of one that I think I tried to jump in at a friend's insistence. And, it, you know, I didn't have really anyone around me playing as well. So maybe if you guys are playing and I'm playing, we'll get into it.
Something
excellent. Holds. Yeah,
that's not good.
I think Brian's kid also would like to play Final Fantasy 14.
How do you feel about Dad playing a nerdy JRPG MMO for 100 something hours? How's that? No,
me neither. No, not a fan of.
I don't blame.
Speaking
her.
Of the Brian, if you need distraction, we can talk without you if you need.
No, it's totally cool. I've been playing It Takes Two, which is my favorite game this year by far. It's been fantastic. It's super, super fun. It's legit probably one of my favorite co-op experiences I've ever had playing a video game, probably since like the first time I played through Super Mario 3D World. I don't think you have to be like expert 3D platforming aficionado to get through this game. I think you can be a totally casual video gamer, partner, roommate, girlfriend, boyfriend, husband, wife, whatever the, and get through this game. Like, it's just super, super fun. It's grounded in a very, in a darker story than I was expecting. This happens in the first few seconds of the game, but just to like kind of briefly explain, it starts with like a couple fighting and, they sit down with their daughter and they're like, we're going to get divorced. And she's like, I made dolls of you and I cried on them. And now you're stuck in the magic hell world that you have to cooperate to survive. So it's like this couple that is on the verge of splitting up forever and their kid being left alone, to then having to fight through this like weird sort of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids nightmare version of their house. And it's just, it's brilliant. It continuously incorporates new mechanics in a really smart, almost Nintendo sort of way, where like they give you this new option to play with and then utilize it in every possible facet. It's super forgiving in terms of like lives and deaths and stuff like that. So you don't have to worry about getting constant game overs. The bosses definitely push back a little bit more than I was expecting, but like when you beat one, it just feels awesome. So yeah, I feel like this game's kind of slept on. I think when you buy the game, it gives you a free copy to give to somebody else, which is really cool, so they can go play it. I'm playing couch co-op with my wife, and we're just like in tears laughing. It's so much fun. So yeah, if you've been cooped up for a while with somebody else in your home, and you're looking for something fun to do together that isn't just like looking at rectangles on Netflix and, you know, falling asleep, check out It Takes Two. It's awesome.
This sounds like the next best thing to a Crash Bandicoot divorce game. I'm sold.
Yeah, this actually, that's how it started in my head canon.
Not enough divorce games, I think, is the message of what you were saying.
Divorce Lucy, Unleashed.
Lucy, anything you've been playing new since Mass Effect?
Nothing of massive note that I've been playing on the PlayStation systems. That I do want to say I put 70... No, I put 80 hours into Bravely Default 2.
Wow.
On Switch. So we don't need to get into it. I have regrets. Moving on.
Fair enough.
Did you like it?
No, I did like it. It's old school. It's an old school Square JRPG. It scratches that itch completely. It's a total delight. I'm enjoying it very much. But yeah, I don't know where those 80 hours came from and why I decided to do that. So,
well, I'm proud of you. I've been playing, as I said, I spent an hour creating a character in Final Fantasy 14, so I'll jump into it and we can start our Beyond Guild. I finally beat the Guardian Ape over the weekend in Sekiro after last weekend.
Nice.
The weekend before, I literally streamed, I think, for 4 hours and couldn't beat it. And then another 3 hours passed and I finally beat it. That was a very, very proud moment, but also just like that fight really tests you in ways of like, you need to be patient. You need to understand every move and where you're at every moment. It's a really, really great, like, teachable. Every boss fight in that game so far has felt like a very good teachable moment for how to play that game.
That thing where, like, you get your ass kicked for an entire day by a boss and then go to bed and then wake up the next day and just beat the shit out of him was one of my favorite feelings in the world. Really, it's like, it's that's so one great. Of those. It's so great. What a joy that is.
It you know, a few weeks back we talked about things that just sucked. That does not suck. to be able to just beat that boss after spending so many hours as Red is showing. It's one of those moments of like disbelief when it happens. But that was great. And then I feel like I've been playing other stuff too, but I can't remember. Oh, I started Hollow Knight finally as well, and have been really enjoying that and finally getting to understand that. The mixture of both like beloved platforming and almost beloved like Soulsborne-esque boss fights in it as well. So I'm really enjoying that too, and can't wait to keep diving into that world. But yeah, it's been, I feel like we're on the cusp of a bunch of stuff coming out. Like as we had said earlier, Returnal is a couple weeks away. Nier Replicant is a couple weeks away as well. Even though Deathloop got delayed, which we had talked about last week, I forgot to bring this up earlier in the news. Deathloop got delayed till September, so that'll move out of May. But we'll have plenty to talk about in May with Resident Evil, Biomutant, and more. But yeah, it feels like the release calendar is going to start to get really crazy all of a sudden. So that should be really fun. Before we wrap up the show, I just wanted to briefly bring up a memory card story. Memory card, of course, is our weekly segment where you, the viewers and listeners at home, write in with your sad, weird, wacky, happy, whatever memories of your PlayStation and gaming life. And we read those on the show. I almost said we weed those on the show. So that's where my voice is at today. You can write into beyond@ign.com with the subject line memory card, and we'll read them on the show in the future. I want to thank everyone who's been writing in. We definitely have a bit of a backlog with them, but please continue to write in. We have a lot of great ones to read. And one of them that I'm going to read comes from Chris. Chris wrote in and said, I've been a PlayStation and Nintendo fan for most of my life, since I was old enough to have enjoyed the NES, the Master System, and European consoles like the Commodore, the Amiga, and the Spectrum. But unfortunately, Chris had an unfortunate experience where they had a partner who cheated on them and left them some years back, and they just stopped playing video games at that point. They couldn't explain why, you know, they started doing that in context, but it just happened, unfortunately. But the PS4 came out, and they decided to take a chance on it, and Chris wrote, I began playing again, started socializing with my old mates, work colleagues, and meeting new players around the world. It helped me come out of my shell, and now with my new PS5. I also have a wife and kid, and I'm happier than I have ever been before. So who says video games are bad for you? I just wanted to read that.
I love that.
A story of coming back from a dark place and how video games helped them through that time.
Maybe I should have done that when I went through my life's biggest breakup instead of going on Lexapro, but we'll never know.
It's
why not both?
Lexapro is one of the hottest gaming handhelds, though. It's up there with the Wonder Swan and the Wellbutrin.
The Super Lexapro is where it's at, though.
The Lexapro was the revision model that came out halfway through the Lexa generation, right?
Yeah, it had an extra controller on it for some reason, like an extra analog stick, but they never used it. It wasn't great. Mm-hmm. Moving on, just another brief one to end on a lighter note as well. Thomas wrote in and said, last week you guys mentioned the Game Shark. I absolutely loved modding my games with it and having lots of fun cheats and unlocked that normally weren't available. This one time, though, it bit me in the butt. I used it when I bought my copy of Final Fantasy VIII, and the main cheats I used were max level and unlimited gil and things like that. But with FF8, enemies scale with your level, so I unknowingly made my game extremely difficult. Believe it or not, cheaters don't always win. And two very different stories about cheating there I thought I would bring up.
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah. Nice.
But thank you to everyone who wrote in. And again, if you'd like to write in, please write in to beyond@ign.com with the subject line memory card, and we'll read them on the show each week. Before we wrap up, wanted to shout out to all of you. Any plugs for either work you've been working on recently that you want to shout out, or anything that you've been reading, listening to, watching, whatnot? Brian, I'll start with you.
I'm reading two books right now. One is... Kenji Lopez's giant sort of like food Bible cooking book, which is amazing. He basically breaks down the sort of scientific logic behind how food is created, which I love. And I just started the Awada Asks book, which is based [S2] Nice. [S1] On a sort of collection of like anecdotes and stories and the old Ask Awada Satoru Awada columns that the Nintendo used to publish. It's a really fascinating sort of look into his philosophy on game development and design, what he was doing for Nintendo at the time. I think he's like one of the most interesting people that ever worked in this industry. And I miss his input a lot, but it's super cool to see what Nintendo's doing these days. And if you want to read sort of where his head was during the sort of peak of a lot of the projects he was working on, go check that book out. It just came out and it's a very brisk read.
Awesome. Lucy, anything you want to shout out?
Yeah, I'm going through a phase right now where all I can listen to are Stephen King podcasts. So I've been listening to The King Cast, which is Scott Wampler, Eric Visby's incredible podcast. The guests they get on that podcast is so good. And I've also been listening to The Company of the Mad, which is a podcast about The Stand. And it's a whole bunch of really notable folk and across literature, across TV and film, reading The Stand during the global pandemic. But what's interesting is that it started right at the very beginning of the global pandemic, and I've only just started listening to it. And it's kind of wild listening to them talk about the pandemic back in like April 2020, because they were so deeply paranoid. And of course they were. I mean, we all were during that time. Like, everyone was like wiping down their groceries and everything. I mean, I never did, but like, you know, a lot of people were. Like, everyone was wearing gloves. The messages that we were getting from the government were so all over the place. And it's really fascinating hearing them read through The Stand, going through that, like the grips of that paranoia that we had back in early 2020.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of pleased that I wasn't listening to it at the time, because I don't think I would have felt that the degree of kind of like hindsight that I feel now, especially as someone fortunate enough to be vaccinated. But it's a great listen. I highly, highly recommend it. And I'm reading alongside. So, you know, if you ever want to revisit The Stand, this is a great place to do it.
That's awesome. The Stand's one of my favorite books. So yeah, I will have to check that out.
God, I love that book. I totally forgot. I watched the CBS show, Paramount Plus, whatever the show is, is really good in the beginning, and then it completely goes off the rails because
that's what I've heard.
There's the last episode. If you jump into it, if you've read the book, don't watch the last episode. Just skip it. pretend it ends when it does, and just call it a day. Because apparently they just hired Stephen King to like write a new ending, and he basically like George Lucas'd it, and it's so bad. But yeah, the stand rules. If you haven't read that book, you should read that book. It kicks ass. In speaking of Guardian Apes, I got this wonderful hardcover collection of Gorillaz stuff, like the band, not the animal. But it's called Gorillaz Almanac, and it's like it hit me that first Gorillaz album turned 20 like last month, which makes me feel ridiculously old.
Wow.
But that was like one of my favorite records ever. I really like the early stuff, and I've been kind of, you know, dabbling in their more recent things, but I've always loved that whole like, hey, let's make a cartoon band and get weird and have lots of collaboration. And this basically feels like one of those sort of like collectible magazines that they'd put out for like random, you know, whatever, it's the biggest movie or like a band or whatever, except it's about a fake band. So it has all these like behind the scenes tour photos and anecdotes about non-existent fake, you know, monkey people who fight zombie apes or whatever. Like it's such a wonder. It's a bunch of like cool, like Jamie Hewlett artwork. And there's like weird, it feels like a very high production value zine.
That's,
and it's
so
neat.
Cool.
It's like, I read the Beastie Boys book, I think earlier or last year, which was the same thing, but about real people. And then this time around, it's about, you know, a cartoon band. So that's neat. It's like $20 on Amazon. So yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. I didn't know that existed. I'll have to go check that out. And yeah, just to wrap up, I have been absolutely obsessed with, UK show called Taskmaster. It's entirely up on YouTube right now. I've blown through like the first 7 series in a couple weeks. It's essentially 5 comedians get tasked with ridiculous things, and the Taskmaster grades them per each episode, and they all are awarded points. It's essentially a game show, but they're all like nonsensical things, like get the ball into the golf, like get the ball into the hole, but you can't carry it, you can't pick it up, the least amount of strokes wins, and it's just across the yard, and they have to find the easiest way to do that. Sometimes it's like, get a gift for the taskmaster that you think he would enjoy the most, or like X, Y, and Z. Each show opens with them bringing something in. It's like, and at the end of the show, each of them, whoever wins all 5 of the things that were brought in at the beginning. And it's like, bring in your shiniest thing, or bring in the thing from a relative you hate the most, or things like that. It's all weird and bizarre, but it is so funny. It's the most I've laughed probably all, you know, pandemic year. It has been just truly hilarious. And I like comfort food. I can't recommend it enough. That's awesome. But other than that, that is pretty much going to wrap us up for this week's episode of Podcast Beyond. Thank you, Brian, Max, and Lucy for joining me for this week. So glad to have you all here together again. So great to have this. Remember, Beyond is live Wednesdays, normally at 3 p.m. Pacific at beyond.ign.com, youtube.com/IGN Games, and your favorite podcast services around the world. You can find us all on Twitter. I'm at JM Dornbush. Brian is at Agent Fizzle. Lucy is at Luce O'Brien, and Max is at Max Scoville. Thank you all again so much for joining me. Thank you to Red, our producer, for helping to make this show happen. And thank you to everyone out there watching and listening. We hope you're safe. We hope you're well. And as always, beyond.
Beyond.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it. Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.